I know this is only episode 16 of Piled High and Deep, the podcast, and, well, at least it's my hope, but this is a project still very much in its infancy, and there are a lot more stories out there to tell of other PhDs. And that's really kind of the theme of today, telling stories. You see, Padraic Kenny, our guest today, he didn't get his PhD to go really stand up in front of a classroom and lecture to college students. He was in it for the stories. He really liked writing and telling stories. And it's not surprising because Padraic has storytelling in his blood. His father is a newspaper guy in Boston. So in college, he found a passion for writing plays. Well, that moved to then telling historical stories.
And the nice thing about it was that you didn't have to make stuff up. It was there. You still had to figure out what it all meant. But that's what drew me in. And so when I thought about the PhD, I thought about it not because I want to be a professor. I just thought, well, writing is important to me. And this kind of writing is important to me. And there are things I want to say. And so that's how I have to do it.
So Padraic found his stories. They were in Poland, and they were about the rise of communism in two cities after World War II. Good plan. Unfortunately, this was the late 1980s, you know, Solidarity. And they were beginning to push out the communists. So in other words, Padraic is there in Poland, and lo and behold, he has a front row to history.
I'm researching something that happens 40 years before, but it's like I'm missing, you know, the big story that's happening right now. And I say big story, you know, because I'm thinking in journalistic terms. I was very aware of a close parallel. And so often, maybe not that often, but sometimes in the fall of 1989, I would think, you are here. This is all happening. You could chuck all of this aside, get out there. You have the contacts and the connections. You could write these stories and, you know, go that route.
Well, Padraic continued telling that story about the rise of communism, and his work has continued to tell the story of other revolutions. He has a new book out talking about political prisoners and the fates that they have faced when they lead revolutions in their own countries. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conti Jr. You can check out more of my stuff on the interwebs at themountaingeek.net. If you want to go directly to the podcast website, that's Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Also, find me on Twitter at The Mountain Geek and Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Wherever you happen to listen to us on the interweb, please leave a comment. I'd like to find out how you found us and what you think of the podcast. I'll also have some additional information on Padraic. I'll have a link to his website, which includes a link to the new book that he has coming out very shortly. Well, and like any good conversation, we'll start by talking about the weather. Let's start shoveling. How's the weather in Bloomington today?
Oh, God, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. So I will at least, I have been outside, and I will gaze upon the campus from my seventh floor window to, so I won't feel too bad about not being out there.
How do you like Indiana?
You know, the mountains are smaller than the ones in Colorado. In fact, they're a lot smaller. I haven't actually seen them yet. So that's definitely a big difference. I'm a very, you know, outdoors person, but the people here are so incredibly nice. And Bloomington is an incredibly cosmopolitan town, really open to the world. And that makes it a great place to be a researcher and a teacher. It's just to live. I mean, it never feels like a place that's cut off from the world. But on the other hand, it's also quiet enough and distant enough from, you know, the main centers of population in this country that I often find when I come back after being somewhere else, like in New York or Washington or whatever, I think, well, that was a lot of fun, but boy, now I can get some work done.
Do you find there's a value in being away from you just said that you're happy to be home, but do you think there's an inherent value in colleges being these little islands unto themselves, whether it's Boulder where you were before, and we'll get to that. Bloomington seems to be that, and this is just from talking to Elizabeth before, there may be kind of like this liberal island in Indiana. I think Austin, you think about that maybe a little bit. Do you think there's some value in that?
Well, you know, I would say this, that it's something that colleges always need to be cognizant of. You know, the contemporary language would be sort of, you know, checking your privilege. And that's kind of overdone language, but it has some truth in it that, you know, being aware of who you are and how you relate to the rest of the world and, you know, the community around you is really important. And that balance has changed in the last 30 years, I would say, because once upon a time, colleges were not economic engines of college towns, or at least they weren't seen that way. But now they're tourist destinations, they're retirement destinations. And so as a result, people, sort of getting back to this liberal island question, people, I think, look at college towns differently from the way they used to. You know, the People's Republic of fill in the blank. Yeah, people will still use that language, but the People's Republic is no longer just a place where you know, people who are different from us hang out. It's where everybody goes because it's got great restaurants and great entertainment, and it's really pretty and all of that. And so there's more interaction, I think, than there used to be. Okay, yeah, that's kind of crass. You know, it's just about coming because there's, you know, some Broadway show playing or whatever it is. But, you know, that's also an opportunity. And I think that we can use that opportunity. But, you know, and part of your question was about, okay, is it important that as a home, it's a community of people who share a set of values? And yeah, I guess I don't feel like that is necessarily the most important thing, because I always want to be aware of people who are different and who might feel excluded by the world that I live in. So I just wouldn't see that as an unalloyed positive thing, that a college town is different from the world around it. On the other hand, you know, I've always lived in college towns. I mean, since I left home for college, you know, well, I guess living in a couple of big cities, which weren't college towns, but in my academic career, you know, I've lived in Ann Arbor, Boulder, and Bloomington. So, you know, three of
those are some pretty significant college towns.
Yeah. Yep.
When you began your PhD journey, and we'll go back even before, is this kind of where you thought you were going to be headed? Is this what your prize was?
I have to say that I didn't think about it at first because I guess I didn't understand what that journey would look like. I didn't really understand academia. And also, 25, 30 years ago, universities didn't do much to talk about career paths, you know, preparing future faculty or preparing for anything else. I mean, I don't think that anybody at Michigan ever talked to me about what I needed to do to set my way forward on towards teaching at a Research One university or anything like that. I don't think that ever came up.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in suburban Boston, in a working class, lower middle class town that was largely Irish, and a town from which, I don't know, maybe a third of the students would go on to a four-year college.
Were your parents college educated?
Yeah, my father had gone to Harvard, and so so we weren't typical for the town. And so I knew about things like that, and I guess that's partly why I ended up going to Harvard. My mother had gone to college as well. She taught English at the high school that I went to.
What did your father do?
My father was a journalist at the Boston Globe. And, you know, I have to say that that was really important to me because writing, and in particular writing to deadline and to specs, let's put it that way, was something that I understood from the beginning.
Was it expected of you early on, elementary, middle school, or junior high or high school? Was the thought put in your head very early that you're going to college?
Oh, well,
that was the
yeah.
expectation?
Well, no, of course I was going to go to college. There was no question about that. In the end, you know, Harvard is where that ended up. But absolutely, absolutely. There was never any question.
As you're going through as you're going through high school, making that college decision, I'm guessing on age here, I think you're probably graduating high school early 80s.
That's right.
How are you making that college decision? Is it Harvard because that's where Dad went and it's close? Or did you look at other options?
Well, I was originally planning to go to the University of Toronto because family members had gone there and I'd visited. It's a pretty cool place. And so I ended up going there for my MA, but I went to Harvard summer school, when I was, after my junior year in high school, because I was studying Russian and I mean, I wasn't going particularly far or fast, at the high school level. And so the idea came up, and I can't remember how, that, you know, Harvard had this summer school program, which included a lot of high school kids. There was a high school component, as well as, you know, others. Anybody could go to Harvard summer school, I guess, but they had a special high school program, and they offered first year Russian. And so I spent that summer learning Russian and falling in love with going to Harvard, and that was that. And I only applied to Harvard, and that worked out.
Even though you were in Boston, how far was the distance great enough that you felt like you got a true away from home college experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was, let's see, if I were to go home, which didn't do all that often, I guess walking out of my dorm room, I could certainly be home in an hour. I think that's about right. Maybe a little bit longer than that. So, you know, I remember that at least 1 year, maybe even a couple of years, my sister and I, she also went to Harvard, we went back to campus like right after Thanksgiving dinner. Like not, you know, push away from the table and go back to school, but, you know, that evening we said, all right, well, we're going to go back. And it's not because we didn't like being home, but, you know, we liked being in school. It was a lot of fun. So back we went.
You mentioned Russian, the foreign language. Was that a driver in your academics, both in high school and college, learning other languages? What other languages do you speak?
Well, before I did Russian, I was studying Latin. So, you know, there's that. And Russian was incredibly important to me in college. And into graduate school. And then I switched over to Polish. And so I haven't used Russian for 30 years. One time I was pretty proficient, but that's a long time ago. And now I use Polish. Because I know both languages, I can make myself understood in most Slavic languages. But Polish is really the language that I know now.
But was Russian the only high school?
Pardon?
Was Latin your only high school language?
That's right. Then, you know, a little bit of Russian. But the 3 years of high school Russian were equivalent to maybe about 2 months of college Russian. So really, I began that in college.
When you were graduating high school, was the idea a degree in Russian and then maybe moving towards business? Or did you have your eye on that?
I was an astrophysics major for a semester. That's what my real passion was. And Russian was just something I was doing for fun. But when I failed or was failing fourth level calculus, I realized that maybe I could do this, but wow, there are people who can do this much more quickly than I can. And I don't think I'm ready to make this kind of commitment. And I was taking Russian and enjoying it. So, okay, goodbye astrophysics, hello Russian. And so Russian studies was what I ended up doing.
And that was the undergrad degree.
Yeah.
Did you, what is it about your undergrad that led you, that you found your most success in and led you down that path to your master's?
Well, somebody was asking me about this recently, and I realized that I could pinpoint the moment pretty well. When I came back from Moscow, where I spent a semester junior year, I was going to write an honors thesis, and I was assigned a thesis advisor, and he knew that I was interested in the Russian Revolution, which I was interested in because I was fascinated by the fact that friends in Moscow who were not proponents of the communist system nevertheless clearly felt a kind of reverence for things connected to the Russian Revolution. So I wanted to understand that kind of ambivalence is the wrong term, sort of two-faced attitude towards the Russian Revolution. On the one hand, well, look what it saddled us with, the Soviet Union and so on, in all its, with all its faults. But on the other hand, wow, those were the days, giants walked the earth or something like that. And so I wanted to understand that. And my advisor suggested, I had a bunch of different ideas, and he suggested that I go look at the microfilms of the Smolensk Archive. And the Smolensk Archive is a collection of materials that the Nazis scooped up when they overran Smolensk in 1941. And they bagged it all up or put it in a train or something and brought it to somewhere in Germany. I can't remember now where. Figuring that, I guess, after the war, they would use it to study the crimes of communism or something like that. But when we invaded Germany, among many, many other things, the U.S. Army found the Smolensk Archive, I think all still bagged up, ready to be looked at. And, so we scooped it up and, took it to Washington, where eventually it was microfilmed and made available to universities. And so it's party records from 1917 to 1941. And I remember the first day that in the reading room of Widener Library at Harvard, I started looking at one of these microfilms and realized, oh my God, these are actual Russian, or excuse me, Soviet documents from 1917. These are party meetings. These are, old Bolsheviks when they were young, trying to figure out how communism is going to work. At the most local level, there were village meetings and city meetings and every level, and I was just blown away by this. I think that's not uncommon as a sort of beginning for a historian to have this. I'm actually looking at history. This is giving me goosebumps. And that's what I felt. And I think before then, if you had asked me a week previous, even as I was, preparing to write an honors thesis, what are you going to do after college? I would have said, oh, I don't know. I really don't know. Hadn't thought about it. But boy, after doing that, I wanted to do history. That's for sure. I didn't understand how that was done exactly. I mean, I was reading books by historians. I was being taught by some historians. But I took very few history classes as an undergrad. So I hadn't thought about it a great deal, but that experience was just earth-shaking for me.
So an undergraduate degree in Russian, or I'm guessing maybe, did they call it Russian studies or Soviet studies?
It was Russian studies.
It was Russian studies. So does that major then look like obviously the language, lots of cultural, you spent a semester abroad studying in Moscow. Was that more of a cultural or a sociological major rather than a pure history major?
Well, it certainly wasn't history. It was multidisciplinary. So I took several literature classes, of course, language classes, politics class. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, sort of history, literature, politics.
You have a degree in Russian culture with the idea that you can hop on a train and have a better than average vacation.
Well, yeah, except
okay,
that.
That's putting it very, very simply, but
that was super. That was great. No, because this was 1985 when I graduated. And so it's not going to be vacation. I suppose. Well, maybe I could put it this way. I didn't get a phone call from the CIA, but I could have.
Right.
It was more that direction. Working in politics.
Was that maybe one of your thought patterns, is maybe I'll go work for, the intelligence folks?
Probably not. Although, I probably would have thought more of journalism, thanks to my father, because I'd met some Moscow correspondents in Moscow, and so was impressed by what they did. And, I love writing. So at that time, I would not have known that to be a CIA analyst also involves a lot of writing. If I'd known that, I probably would have said, oh, that's pretty cool. If they'd called me, I probably would have said, tell me more. That's pretty interesting. And I did go to work in Washington the summer after college. I'd already been accepted and was already making plans to go to Toronto. But in March, I sent out a bunch of letters, just blind, to all the various places that might need a Russia analyst, offering to be an intern for the summer. And everybody said no. And then Radio Free Europe wrote back and said, well, actually, sure. Not Radio Free Europe, but Radio Liberty, its Russian counterpart. And so I interned with them that summer. Worked for them and then did some translating to make money. I did some translating work for the Department of Defense. I had a bit of experience with that. And so I suppose that, one of those directions could easily have happened as well.
You went immediately then. So you have this summer between undergrad and your master's.
Yeah, and then I go straight on.
Did you get a master's, or did you just kind of move then to the PhD?
Well, I didn't really understand that you could just go straight to a PhD. I thought you had to first do a master's somewhere and then do a PhD somewhere else. Because again, the vocational or career training or advising or whatever at Harvard in the early 1980s was zero. So nobody ever explained to me how this works. I never got any advice on which schools to apply for, nothing at all. And so I went to Toronto for a year, did my master's.
Because you had family members that had gone there before, right?
Yeah. And I thought, wow, this is a really cool place. And I went up to visit, and they were just so incredibly welcoming. I saw this was a real academic community. I wanted to be part of it.
And you just said, before I cut you off, you were there a year?
Yeah, just 1 year. It was a 1-year master's. during which I wrote a master's thesis also on the Russian Revolution and Civil War. But during that time, I began to think about Poland and applied to spend a year in Poland, and did. So after a year in Toronto, I went to Poland.
We'll get back on that track. I want to touch base on something that you had said. You've said it twice, so it's important. You did not have any guidance in right. terms of finding a master's program or moving on or understanding what it took to become a PhD. You thought you had to stair step it. You had to meet expectations and goals. You had to get a master's before you get a PhD. Yeah. How much of that has changed in today's academic environment?
Boy, so much has changed. The biggest thing that has changed is that, I think different kinds of gaps and different relationships have opened up between the MA and the PhD, because whereas at that time, programs tended to admit a lot of PhD students and not give them any funding, and then they would eventually fall by the wayside, and some would soldier on. You'd have these big seminars and so on. Now, almost all programs admit a very small number of students into the PhD and fund them fully. They don't fund them, richly, but they're funded. And so that has changed. And then what that also means that since most programs are no longer getting money from their PhD students, they are more and more getting it from their MA students. And so they're admitting MA students who are, their high school teachers who need more training, or librarians, or one of the things we do here at Indiana is we admit to the MA program students who have interest in and ability in Russian or East European history, but they don't have the language. And, they're stuck because, maybe someone went to a school where, they only offer 2 years of Russian or no Russian, forget about Polish or Czech or whatever. And so they'll never be able to do the kind of stuff they're passionate about. And an MA allows them to get the language skill and the credentials that allow them to apply for a PhD. And we've seen a number of students come through and do exactly that. At the beginning, they'd have no hope of getting into a top PhD program. And after 2 years, they do. So that's a very, very different. The MA, therefore, is not necessarily, it still can be a way station towards a PhD, but not necessarily. And I suppose that's always been true. I mean, not everybody who does an MA does a PhD. But maybe I would put all this together by saying that if once upon a time schools didn't have to really put too much thought into what happened to their students after they finished, now they do. And so there's lots more thinking about that, both the MA and the PhD level. And that's changed both of them markedly.
Ultimately, why did you get your PhD?
Because writing and telling stories is so important to me. There's another piece to this, that before I became a historian, I wrote plays. That was my real passion as an undergraduate and in high school as well. And I don't know if I was particularly good at it, but my plays were produced, and I was very active in theater as a lighting designer as well. So I lived around the theater. Harvard had this incredible theater community, probably still does, where any given semester there'd be 40 or so plays, all of them, of course, acted, but directed, produced, and designed by students entirely. There was not a theater department that was, helping us. So one could really live in that world, and that way of telling stories was very appealing to me. And as I got more and more into history, I think without thinking about it, I came to realize that this was another way of telling stories and trying to make sense of the world around me, which I think I was trying to do through the theater. And the nice thing about it was that you didn't have to make stuff up. It was there. You still had to figure out what it all meant. But that's what drew me in. And so when I thought about the PhD, I thought about it not because I want to be a professor. I didn't think that that's not what I want to do. I just didn't think about it. Honestly, I didn't. I did not look at my MA professors or back at undergrad and say, oh, I want to be like them. I just thought, well, writing is important to me. And this kind of writing is important to me. And there are things I want to say. And so that's how I have to do it. It's amazing that they bought that line, because it's not maybe the most compelling reason to do a PhD. Again, this was in the day when, you know, they admitted a lot of people. You know, so there was some logic, I guess there was some logic to it that made sense also to the department at Michigan.
How did you choose Michigan?
Good question.
I know that ultimately the dissertation, I had it here just a minute ago. Do you still remember the title of it?
It's got a gerund in there, Building People's Poland, something like that.
It is Building People's Poland, Resistance and Transformation in Working Class Communities and the Coming of Stalinism to Poland in 1945 to 1949.
That sounds right. Yep.
When did that grab you? Was that during a transformation during your master's? Because I think that's, you had said that that Poland had kind of caught your eye at that point.
Yeah. So I, already as a master's student, I began to think, okay, I really enjoy writing about the Russian Revolution. But I'm interested in this phenomenon of people, workers in particular, being attracted to revolutionary change and therefore participating in a revolution that turns out to be communist, partly because they understand and support the ideas, partly because they maybe don't. And then eventually the revolution is shown to be something quite different from what they had hoped it would be. But nonetheless, enthusiasm. And that's a recognized fact. And then too, it was a recognized fact about the Russian Revolution. But it wasn't so for Eastern Europe. I mean, people would say, well, sure, the communists were popular in Yugoslavia because, you know, Tito and the partisans liberated the country. And they were popular in Czechoslovakia, where the communists won a free election in 1946. But Poland, that's, you know, a tough case where, you know, it was recognized that Poland was the country most ready to stage uprisings throughout the communist period and before that, for that matter. And so what was their relationship to communism? And I had started learning Polish as an undergrad. So I was already sort of interested in it. I mean, just because I was learning another Slavic language. And so Poland kind of rose to the top as, this would be a great case if I'm interested in revolution and workers in revolution. You know, there are lots of people working on that in the Russian case, but there aren't in the Polish case. And so I want to do that.
And is that how you, so because of Poland, you found Michigan?
Yes.
Or did you find Michigan and you brought Poland along with you?
No, I found, I probably applied to some other places. I can't remember where, but there aren't that many places even today, and there weren't that many then, that had strong expertise in things Polish. So chose Michigan because, well, you know, on the one hand, there was a great Russian history program there, and I had used some of the work of Russian historians there, William Rosenberg in particular, who became co-advisor of my dissertation. I'd used his work for my master's thesis on railway workers. But at the same time, it also had a Polish studies tradition, and their historian, Roman Szporluk, was very encouraging when I went to meet him when I was still considering applying. And so I got the idea this was a place where I could do Poland, but there were people who understood the kinds of things I wanted to write about, who were open to that.
You approached this from the standpoint of telling a story of people rather than telling the facts and figures of a time of history. Would that be correct?
That's correct, except I would add to it that the choice was also an analytical one, in that, so on the one hand, yes, stories, but my work is not, I wouldn't say my work is story driven. Or the research is not story driven. That's what ends up happening, because that's who I am and how I write, but the research is driven analytically. Here's a problem I want to work out. Here are the cases that will allow me to work that problem out. And so in the case of revolution, it's, well, I can work out this question or these questions through the Polish case. It'll allow me to talk about things in ways that I think I need to talk about. And then once I have Poland, then I can say, all right, how within Poland can I approach that problem analytically? What are the cases within Poland that allow me to do this? So I think in those terms of case choosing. And when I'm doing that, it's not in terms of, where are the great stories? Maybe I just assume that great stories will always be there. And, probably they are.
You just got to dig them out of people.
Yeah.
That's what I'm learning.
That's right.
That's what I'm learning how to do here. I find it really interesting. So I want to go back. Give me a second here. I'm going to bounce back and forth here. Mm-hmm. For the honors thesis for your undergrad, you come back from Russia and you find this great archive based on documents that were gathered up by the Nazis and then ended up in the United States. So right there, right in the United States, via microfilm, fish film, you have access to actual documents produced by the early Soviets, the Bolsheviks.
Yep.
What's your process then to get for your analytical part of your dissertation?
Well, so I went to Poland right after my master's to kind of figure out, was this doable? Keep in mind, this is still the communist period and nobody's carted off train loads of documents from early communist Poland. So the real question as to whether such a dissertation is viable. So I had funding from the International Research and Exchanges Board, IREX, to go to Poland as a kind of a scouting mission. Improve my Polish, make contacts, but also figure out, can this research be done? And to be honest, by the end of that year, 1987, when I'm then returning and starting at Michigan, it's still not obvious that it can be done because archives aren't open. I, towards the end of that year in Poland, I applied just to see if I could. I applied to get into the archives and was told no. So I went back to the States, started the program, but, you know, continued to think about how I was going to do this kind of research.
You were really focused on this immediate post-war part of Poland, though, right?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to write about the Communist Revolution, and that's when it was. And, lots of people, and I totally understand it, come into graduate school thinking, what am I going to write about? What am I interested in? I knew exactly what I was going to write. I mean, I didn't know, what I was going to argue exactly, but I knew the time period and the focus and the type of argument that I hoped to be making. That's absolutely true. That's the kind of thing that I would be, as a PhD advisor, I would be cautious of, are you sure? So there's a bit of confidence there that could have been overconfidence. Had communism not fallen, I don't know how I would have done this. I imagined that I would spend a year reading the newspapers, the early communist newspapers, just going through them and sort of figuring out as much as I could from that. But as it turns out, I didn't have to.
So what were you able to get to? I mean, were you finally able to get into those archives?
Well, look, in the 2 years I spent at Michigan doing coursework and applying for grants, communism fell. By the time when I was writing my grant proposals in the fall of 1988, communism was, I wouldn't say necessarily going strong, because I'd been there over the summer of 88. I got married there in Poland that summer. And so during the strikes that were going on, so I knew that, I knew about dissent and opposition and all that, but, communism is still going. And by the time I got the grants, the communists, or the grant from, again, from IREX, the communists had agreed to roundtable discussions with Solidarity. And by the time I went over, the communist government had been replaced by a Solidarity-led government. And I arrived in Warsaw just in time to kind of bluff my way into the parliament in Warsaw to watch the first non-communist prime minister take his oath of office and swear in his cabinet and deliver a speech. That was not expected when I was making my plans. I don't think I have the grant proposals I wrote, but I'm probably promised that I would get into archives, but I hope that I would be able to pull strings or something. But realistically, I was gonna look at this talk to scholars, maybe do some interviews and read newspapers. And instead, I was able to get into every possible archive.
So I'm going to back up. You kind of buried something in there. You got married. Let me guess, that first trip to Poland, you met a girl?
Basically, yep. Yep. I had actually met her in Moscow. And so so we knew each other. But then when I went to Poland, it turns out that things were going to be going a different direction. And we're still married 30 years later. So that worked out.
She's a lovely woman. I met her over the summer. Thank you.
Oh, that's right. You did. Yes, you
yes,
did.
Yes, we did. Yes.
Yes. But yes, I did kind of bury that story there, because I do think of my path to Poland as being on these two, these two paths simultaneously. And I can't really privilege one over the other. It was important that I had come to know this wonderful place and this wonderful woman, but it was also important to me that I had an agenda that I really needed to explore. If I had decided it was something different that I needed to explore, if I had decided that, okay, I'm going to get married in Poland, but I'm going to study the Yugoslav Revolution and learn Serbo-Croatian, well, I would have done that. But Poland made sense.
What was that last, the last push? So you said you spent 5 years on your PhD. So we got two, you got that first year's in Poland, then you're doing some classwork, then you're back in Poland.
Right.
So then you had 3 years of writing?
No, just 2 years. 2 years.
2 years of writing? Okay, yeah. Years of writing?
Uh-huh. Is that right? 89, 90? Yeah, because I came back in June of 90 and I defended in March of 92. So a year and a half. Yeah,
2 years of writing.
Yeah.
Well, and you said before, you enjoy writing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. First of all, I came back with great stories. The comparison between these two cities in Poland that I had chosen for the research turned out to work wonderfully and to work in ways that I could think about analytically, but also furnishing me with good stories to tell, strikes and migration across Poland and political battles. It was all there. Just a question of telling those stories and embedding them within the analytical framework that was emerging for me. And so, yes, it was a question of looking at everything that I had read and thinking, okay, how does this come together into a story? And at that point, yes, I think my instincts for, or my predilection for pulling together voices in order to tell a story that I think makes sense. That's what drove me through the writing process.
How much of the second of the Solidarity Revolution, how much impact or what role did it play in what your dissertation was about?
Well, I mean, it was extremely important later, because I ended up writing four or five books about the, depending on how you count it, about the fall of communism. But at the time, it was a source of maybe you could say professional anxiety, because I was aware that. Here I am, I'm interested in revolution. And there is revolutionary change taking place right now in Poland. And I'm going off to the archives every day. I'm
researching something that happened 40 years before.
Yeah, I'm researching something that happens 40 years before, but it's like I'm missing, the big story that's happening right now. And I say big story, because I'm thinking in journalistic terms. I was very aware of a close parallel. The British historian Timothy Garton Ash is 8 years older than I am, and 9 years earlier, he had been researching his dissertation in Berlin. I believe it was on something about politics in the Nazi period or the late Weimar period. I'm not sure. But there he is in Berlin, and the first Solidarity Revolution breaks out in August of 1980, and he essentially chucks aside his dissertation, gets on a train, I guess, goes to Gdańsk, learns Polish, hangs out in Gdańsk and elsewhere in Poland for much of the Solidarity period, gets to know all of these people. Of course, some of them he can speak in English or German with, and before his Polish gets good enough, I guess. And he becomes a renowned journalist before eventually going back, and now he's a professor at Oxford. And he's published history as well as his journalistic work. But I knew that story. And so often, maybe not that often, but sometimes, in the fall of 1989, I would think, you are here, this is all happening. You could chuck all of this aside, get out there. You have the contacts and the connections. You could write these stories and, you know, go that route. It's a much less certain route, obviously. But I had written a fair amount of op-ed pieces and news articles for the Boston Globe. So I knew how to do it. And I could have, you know, gone, that's not, I think, in my nature to risk things like that, you know, to just throw aside something that I'm, you know, being paid to do and take a risk on something entirely new. But I sure could have, and I sure thought about it, because there was a sense that, you know, I'm a fool, that I'm missing history.
For a historian to be right in the mix of it, that's a hard pull to ignore. What were you going to say?
Yeah. So there, I remember one day I was, this was, I think, in October, early November, I was heading to the archive, and I had a small apartment. My wife stayed in her hometown, and I would go up to Warsaw 4 days a week, 4.5 days a week, for much of the first few months. And I had a small apartment on the north side of Warsaw, and the archive was on the south side of the city center. So a good 45-minute ride. And ordinarily, before getting on the bus, I would buy the newspaper. This was the Solidarity-sponsored, no longer now opposition newspaper, but, you know, it was a must-read. And so I would grab the newspaper, and I'd read it on the bus. And as we're going along, I read a story that today they're going to be dismantling, at the time they were saying temporarily, the statue of the hated Polish Bolshevik Felix Dzerzhinsky, the guy who started the secret police in Soviet Union, also known as Bloody Felix, and they're going to be taking it down. And I thought, okay, there's a story. All right, I'm not going to the archives. And so I hopped off the bus, went over to the square where the statue was, and found this huge crowd milling around the statue and grabbing at it and hacking at it. And so I got in the mix and grabbed myself a piece of the statue, which I still have today. It's part of the letter N from Dzerzhinsky. And sort of hung out in the crowd and kind of enjoyed that. And then probably I put the piece of the statue in my pocket and went on to the archives because I had stuff I had to look at. So, you know, sometimes I could balance things. At the end of December of 89, my wife and I went for a few days to Berlin and, you know, scooped up pieces of the Berlin Wall and sort of hung out there. And then in February, I went to Prague to sort of see how the revolution was going. But, you know, mostly I stuck it out 8-10 hours a day in the archives, and always thinking, what about that other revolution? So my goodness, it was present for me all the time. And it didn't affect what I wrote, I would say. I don't think that I could look at the dissertation or the book that came out of it and say, this is shaped by the revolution of 89. But it was always present in my mind, that's for sure.
Dissertation finishes up. What'd you do after that?
Well, I went straight from there to the University of Colorado. There were only 3 jobs that year in East European history. But as it happens, they had decided that they really wanted to hire a social historian and they really wanted to emphasize the 20th century. And they really thought that a Polonist would be a good idea. And so that's me. So it's not like, in a way, you know, it's not like I beat out, you know, 100 other candidates or whatever. I mean, I was that person. And I had at that point, actually, when they offered me the job, I hadn't yet defended and I had no publications, but I was almost done and I had a good story to tell. And so I went straight from Michigan, straight out to Colorado, from one college town to the next.
Was that in the history department?
Yeah,
at CU?
The history department, absolutely. Which is a great department to be in. It was a wonderful place. For a couple of reasons.
They gave me a degree there, so you know, I'm not going to complain. That's where I got my degree in history from, so you know, I'm not going to complain.
Absolutely.
I do remember, you know, that was an interesting time to be studying history with all the change going on in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes me wonder how much more there is that can be uncovered from that period. I mean, there are a tremendous number of lost opportunities to study that period in Europe. And are there students that are going out and asking those questions?
I think there's still so much to be done. You know, the study of just thinking of the study of communist Eastern Europe, there are so many areas that have not been really well developed. And so I'm continually still seeing a next generation, you know, in part because, look, my generation, and here I'm thinking of historians in Eastern Europe as well as here, my generation experienced communism. We were there. We have a feeling for it, and that's great. That gives an immediacy that's not irrelevant. You know, I was able to interview workers who had been workers in the 1940s, and I was able to interview them, you know, 40 years later. And you know, now that's much harder to do. You know, let alone that the you know, memories are just changing, but there are also fewer people. So great, I had that immediacy, but you know, I won't say that it has disadvantages, but maybe I'll just say that a next generation, you know, we now have young historians who have no adult memory of communism. You know, barely they would have been born during the communist period, but you know, as little, very little children. And we have graduate students now who were born after the communist period. So they bring a different way of looking at things. They're going to ask questions that it's not that my generation might not ask, but they might be quicker to ask it or ask it in a different way. So, you know, one of the things that the study of Eastern Europe really attunes you to generational differences, because generations are defined in part by, you know, traumatic or dramatic events. And so 89 does separate out generations. And so in a way, I belong to the 89 generation. And people who come from a later generation, they're just going to ask different things and look at different things. So boy, there is so much more that can be done.
So the dissertation becomes a book.
Yep.
Like all good, or like many good dissertations do.
Right.
What did you do? Where did your academic focus take you from there? Colorado probably only gave you a couple of years to get settled, and then they were, you know, demanding that you publish or perish.
I never felt that, and that's because, you know, well, I write and then I publish, and it's just not something I really thought a great deal about. The book came out early enough that I never had to really think about tenure, and I didn't worry about what my next research was going to be. It took a while to get there, to figure out. I knew that I wanted to write about 1989 because I'd been there, because I knew that I had to do that. But the problem there was, well, I'm a historian, so what is the story about 1989 that I can have? If I'm a political scientist or a sociologist or an anthropologist, it's a different kind of question, but I'm a historian, and that's not a limiting condition. That's a description of the method that is important to me. So, okay. So what is that story? And, you know, it could have been something about workers because I had, you know, worked in labor history. But gradually I realized that I think it was as I was reading journalists and somewhat political scientists' accounts of 1989 that I said, well, no, they're missing something that I saw there. And what I saw was my generation of activists, people who were in high school or college or just after college, 18 to 30 years old in 1989, who had these really vibrant movements that I thought mattered a whole lot. And nobody's writing about that. And that is what I need to write about. And so the social movements, the grassroots social movements of the late 1980s, you know, the time period when I had first arrived, you know, really I'm writing about the period 86 to 89, going back a little bit to the early 80s. That was going to be my focus. And so that's profoundly influenced by my experience there. But then the difficult task of saying, okay, right, but what is that as a story in history? And that's what I had to figure out. And once I had that figured out, then actually it was as with the first projects, like, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I know what I have to do. And I just have to go and do it and you know, figure out how to collect that information and render it into a monograph.
How many more trips to Poland did you get? Or I guess at this point, since you're married to a gal from that neighborhood, you're going often.
Yeah, I'm going every year, although I got funding to go for a whole year to do that research, and then followed up with several more summers because originally it was going to be a book about Polish social movements. But in the end, I went and talked to and read the documents of and so on, movements from the former Czechoslovakia, the former Yugoslavia, Ukraine, East Germany, and Hungary. And so it, you know, expanded quite a bit because I became really interested in the networks that linked these social movements. So I had to go several more times. I ended up interviewing 300 people in 12 countries because I also went all over Western Europe to talk to Western activists who were in contact with them. Most of the people I talked to were born after the late 1950s, late 1950s or later, through the early 1970s. So this was it was definitely a generational study. I probably only talked about maybe a dozen people who are older than that. I was going back and forth to Poland and then discovering that, gee, actually, if I go to Prague, I can understand Czech. I can read their underground materials or their books. I can talk to Czechs who don't speak English. Some of them spoke Polish. I did that in Slovakia and Ukraine as well. In East Germany and Hungary, I needed translators if they didn't know English. And in Slovenia, everybody spoke English. That was easy enough. And then Western Europe, same deal. So it was, in some ways, it was a research, it was research driven in ways not unlike what I'd done before.
When did you transform that research, and then tell me about that, because you stayed focused on, your focus has continued on revolution.
Yeah, that's right.
You have a book coming out that takes a little bit more focus than on those people that are the leaders of revolution and those that are in charge.
Well, so
trying to squash them.
Well, so if there's a through line, there probably is a through line through all of this. I'm interested in the experience of dramatic political change, the social experience of dramatic political change. The first book, Rebuilding Poland, the second book, A Carnival of Revolution, that was very much looking at people experiencing and contributing to, and sometimes reacting against, revolutionary change. You know, they're in the midst of something which maybe they've contributed to, and they're trying to make sense of it and trying to realize their own goals or dreams. You know, I should say that one of the things that attracts me to the study of revolution is I think of revolution as, my definition of revolution is as a rupture in ordinary time. So in ordinary time, we don't think about, wouldn't it be great to have a monarchy, or wouldn't it be great if we all lived on communes, or wouldn't it be great if there were no more of this group of people that I hate, or wouldn't it be great if money disappeared, or, you know, whatever, all those utopias that from the right and the left that are, you know, that we don't think about them because we've got lives to lead. But when ordinary time is ruptured, all of a sudden, all of those ideas come out. And you can see people engaging in thoughts and in actions that are not feasible other times. And I just use the passive voice, but that's not accurate, of course, because people are themselves rupturing that time, but they're not doing it at a random time. It's because it's possible in part because the regime is weakening, or the international situation is what it is, or people have just had enough, or, you know, some unexpected moment like the Chernobyl explosion, you know, drives people to think, wow, I can't stand on the sidelines anymore, whatever it is. That's what's really exciting to me about revolutions. But I guess more broadly, I'm interested in how people experience dramatic change. And again, something I would add to that is that I think there are broadly two types of historians. I might even say two types of social scientists. So some social scientists study, in a sense, themselves. The people or the communities that are close to them in some way. And so most people who study, you know, in this country, study America, would be in that category, although not everyone. And then others study people who are different from them. And that's me. I'm not a Pole and I'm not a worker, but I'm also not somebody who takes an active role in political events. And so I'm fascinated by that, by that commitment, by that willingness to take a risk. And I look at somebody who stands up in a demonstration or throws himself or herself 100% into some social movement, or for that matter, spends years in prison for something he or she believes in. And I say, wow, I can't do that. What's it like? I want to understand it, because it's alien to me. And alien to me in a way that, but it's also, well, not exactly aspirational, because I don't necessarily want to do that. But it is something that as a starting point, let's say I admire. This does not mean that I admire all the people I write about. I'm perfectly happy to write about people I don't admire, but I can admire in all cases, or probably most cases at least, I can admire their motivations. And their willpower. Maybe it's that simple. So I'm humbled by that, by somebody who can spend years in prison or who can go out into a demonstration knowing that the police are there with their water cannons, or go on strike knowing that it might be pointless and might cost you something. And I want to understand that. And so that's what always drives me.
You've written nonfiction on a professional level now for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself interested in going back to those plays that you got so much drive and satisfaction out of in high school and college?
You know, some people have said about Carnival of Revolution that it's filmic, that they can see the story as if it's a film. And when people said that, I looked back and said, I see what you mean, but you've got the wrong genre. I just wrote a play. Only thing is it's in prose. And the last part of that book is entitled A Revolution in 16 Scenes. And, I get that you can look at that and say, oh, they're movie scenes. Sure. And I wasn't consciously thinking I'm now writing 16 scenes from a play. They don't quite work that way. Because I had to stay loyal to the sources I had and the argument I wanted to make. And so sometimes some of those scenes I think could be quickly rendered into drama form, and others you'd have to jettison a lot and add stuff. So that's by way of saying that no. I feel like I'm still doing that. It's just in a different form.
What do you see as you see yourself teaching for quite a long time and just continuing down this road?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm a restless teacher and a restless researcher. In terms of teaching, I'm always curious about finding something new to teach, because for me, teaching is a way of working out ideas. Teaching for me is something that's very uncertain.
What are you teaching this semester?
I'm teaching a course called What is History? It's a required course for our undergraduates, and it's a new course as well, and I've never taught it before. It's an opportunity to talk about, okay, so what does it mean to do history and, you know, to encounter documents and to tell stories and so on. And I'm teaching a senior seminar on prisons and prisoners. So all the students are writing research papers in some way related to prisons and prisoners. And that I've taught a few times before, although not in this form. In the past, it's been on political prisoners specifically, and now it's more broad. I'm always interested in trying to teach something new. I mean, last year I taught a course called Techniques of Contemporary Revolution, where, you know, we looked at current and recent revolutions all over the world. And I have no problem with talking in class about China or the Philippines or the Arab Spring. Because it's not about being an expert and then just conveying that knowledge. It's about exploring uncertainties. A student once wrote on an evaluation, I really treasure this comment. I don't know why, but I have the feeling he's making it all up. And I thought, yeah, I'm not, but I totally get why you think that. Because I'm up there saying, well, you know, that's really interesting what you've just said, because you could put it like this, or perhaps another way of thinking about it would be such and such. And I'm thinking these things through, but I can picture a student in the back of the class going, wait, what? I thought he knew. But so it's an exploration, and so obviously is research. You know, one of the reasons I moved away from the Russian Revolution and Civil War is because I thought, it's not like I know it solidly. I mean, that would be hubris, because, you know, all I'd written was two shorter theses, you know, combined maybe 200 pages. I knew some sources and all that, but I'd never done research in Russia. So that would be hubris to say I knew it, but there's a sense of, okay, I get it. Give me something totally different. Okay, Poland, that's really different. And then, you know, working in 1989, and then working on political prisoners, which took me I mean, there's some other books in between, which also went different directions to other countries. But the book that's just come out on political prisoners, entitled Dance in Chains, took me to research in South Africa, Ireland, Northern Ireland, in London, and took me back to the 19th century, which is very unfamiliar for me, or was. And that's because, you know, I just wanted to, there's something I needed to figure out. And so that's what I needed to do. So that's all by way of saying that I'm always looking for something new to be doing. And I could foresee a situation in which I say, yeah, I don't think that that is accomplished by writing another book, or that's not accomplished by teaching. You know, it could be, maybe it would be accomplished by working in higher administration at the university, because those are also ways of achieving some of the same kinds of things. But it really depends on what the questions are. And I mean, the great thing about being a historian is that you can choose what the questions are. Sometimes you don't get to choose in other situations. You know, if you're if your world of research is in law or business or administration, for that matter, or in government, you don't get to choose what your research is. And we have that independence of being able to say, this is something I feel is really important, so I need to figure it out. And so that's a really wonderful thing. But again, that's not true for everybody. And that's not true in every situation.
Would 18-year-old or 19-year-old Padraic Kenny be pretty pleased with the life that mid-50s Padraic Kenny has?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'm surrounded by books. I get to read and travel, you know, about as much as I can handle. There are people who travel much more than I do, but I travel as much as I can handle. And I get to talk about things that I'm really interested in. I get to talk about them with students who are interested in that, or with colleagues who are interested, or, you know, in the public where people are interested in that. And so, yes, absolutely. While it wasn't a linear path, or wasn't a straight path, I guess I want to say, there is a line that connects back to who I was then. And, you know, if I didn't end up in the theater, which probably I imagined at 18, that's something I could have done. I certainly didn't end up being an astrophysicist. The world I'm in now would definitely make a lot of sense if I were to go back to that person.
Padraic Kenny, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for shoveling with us on Piled High and Deep.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Padraic Kenny, thank you very much for your time. And we had a few technical challenges, but we got through it okay. Thanks to the great folks at Zencastr. That's a wonderful application that I'm using to talk to folks remotely. Oh, the other person I really have to thank in this is Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. She was the very first podcast guest. And Padraic and Elizabeth worked together in Boulder and also there at Indiana, and they share the same love of Poland. And Elizabeth, I love you. Thank you very much for putting us together. Padraic's new book is Dance in Chains, Political Imprisonment in the Modern World. I'll have a link to his website and to the book in the description. Thanks for listening today. Always appreciate it. And if you like what you hear, please leave me a comment on whatever it is, podcast application that you use to listen to podcasts, or leave a comment on the website at phdthepodcast.net, or tweet at me at Piled High and Deep, the podcast. More Benjamin Clementine in the background. This is from his first album, and it's a good one. It's Nemesis. Check it out. Came out in 2015. Worth your time. Well, until we talk again, keep shoveling.